From New England Public Radio in Springfield, Massachusetts, this is NEPR News Now. Stories you really shouldn't miss. Thanks for listening. I'm Sam Hudzik, the news director at New England Public Radio. Coming up, a Springfield high schooler has known since childhood that he was a boy, but it hasn't been easy.
Sometimes my family gets frustrated with me for behaving like this, for behaving like myself.
Then a landscaping project at a national historic site is anything but simple.
We have prepared for this project for actually 5 years. We have archaeologists on site, and they are watching them, you know, as they dig.
And we take you to beautiful Stockbridge, Mass, for a meeting of the tastiest book club around.
This is actually a salad, an orange, fennel, and onion salad. But it is kind of nice, and the only problem is, of course, that you have to take all the pith out of the oranges.
All that, and a definition of pith, just ahead on NEPR News Now. First, these early weeks of the Trump administration have been marked by controversy, including a court battle over the president's executive orders on immigration, unsubstantiated accusations against a former president, and numerous presidential tweet storms. But supporters of the president say he's delivering exactly what he promised. In part two of our series, 1 Million Red Voters in Blue State, WBUR's Anthony Brooks picks up our story in the town of Ware.
The red brick mill buildings along Main Street are reminders that Ware was once a booming mill town, known as the town that can't be licked. The Berkshire Blanket Company is still headquartered here. But most of the mill jobs are long gone. And here along Main Street, there are vacant storefronts, some of them boarded up. So many here liked Donald Trump's promise to bring back jobs.
Can I ask you how you voted in the election?
Yes, I did vote for Donald Trump.
Now, you sort of lowered your voice like you didn't want everyone to hear.
No. I did vote for Donald Trump.
This is Nicholas Fantangoli. He teaches history, government, and sociology at Ware High School, and he represents a political shift in this part of Central Mass. Fantangoli comes from a working-class family with deep Democratic roots, but he says the last election tugged some of those roots right out of the political soil.
My dad, who is a big Democrat, has been a Democrat since John Kennedy was in office, voted Trump this time. It was the only time he had ever switched over since Ronald Reagan.
Fantangoli has another way to measure the political shift. For the past three elections, he's organized a presidential poll at Ware High School for students, teachers, and staff. In 2008 and 2012, they voted for Barack Obama. And in 2016, the winner was
Donald Trump, and our vote on that was 151 for Trump, 138 for Clinton.
Fantangoli's poll reflects the real elections in Ware, which is part of a line of central Massachusetts towns that stretch from the New Hampshire border south to the Connecticut line, that voted twice for Obama and then shifted for Trump. Although he still supports Trump, Fantangoli is concerned about the stormy beginning of Trump's presidency.
I mean, we have to see what happens at the conclusion of those first 100 days. Frankly, right now, it's not looking good for him.
As a public school teacher, Fantangoli is particularly disappointed in Trump's pick for Education Secretary Betsy DeVos, who's a proponent of school choice. But like many here, he's hopeful that Trump can make good on his promise to bring back jobs and help communities like Ware.
Much of President Trump's appeal to a lot of the people here was talking about manufacturing, and I think that resonated.
The promise that Trump made, or the hope that he raised in a town like Ware, that he can bring manufacturing jobs back, you know, is that really going to happen?
I think it's going to be difficult. And one of the reasons for that is the fact that many of the factories have been closed down. They've been closed down for a long while. To get them back operational is going to require a lot of capital. And the reality of it happening, I don't know.
This is the village of Gilbertville, just down the road from Ware. There's an elegant stone church on Main Street and a beautiful red-covered bridge that spans the Ware River. It's also a reminder of past economic glory. The two woolen mills shut down long ago, and right between them is the Whistle Stop restaurant. Every Wednesday, a group of locals gathers here to drink coffee and chat. Most of them voted for Trump, and they like to call themselves the Deplorables. Gilbertville is part of Hardwick, another Trump town. These men are retired, some of them working class guys who grew up as Democrats but now vote Republican. They sit on a bench under an American flag, sip their coffee from Trump coffee mugs, and talk about the president's first weeks in office.
I really like what he's doing with the immigrant thing there. I know a lot of people disagree.
This is Paul Mylott of Hardwick, who says Trump's hard line on immigration is an effort to enforce the law, which he says is only fair.
I think he's there to do that.
What are we going to do with more than 11 million people who are here illegally, a lot of them working, a lot of them sort of part of the fabric of our society now? Do we throw them all out, or how do we deal with that?
Well, it depends on how they got here. If they came here illegally, yeah, throw them out. If they came here and become a U.S. citizen and they're working, yeah, you can stay here, but if not, get out.
If he builds the wall like he did, like he's talked about, I'll be satisfied.
And this is Bob Bousquet, also from Hardwick. Building the wall along the Mexican border was, of course, one of Trump's biggest campaign promises, and many here support it. And they buy Trump's unsubstantiated allegation that illegal immigrants are responsible for high levels of crime and deprive Americans of jobs.
They have to stop. I mean, we don't even have enough jobs for people that actually want to work.
But, I mean, have you seen evidence here in this part of the state of jobs being taken away by people coming into this country illegally?
No, they've already been taken away. I mean, this place was a thriving community. People came on buses here to this place. Everything that was isn't. It's all closed down.
The fact that the mills shut down long ago has little or nothing to do with illegal immigration. But the sentiment touches on a recurring theme in this region, a sense of regret about a past that is no longer here. And Trump connects with folks here for other reasons as well.
I liked what he said. I could understand what he said.
This is Bill Ward, a retiree, who says he likes what he's seen so far, including the choice of Trump's millionaire and billionaire cabinet members.
What I find kind of comical is how so many people are so upset because Trump and his cabinet are all very wealthy people. Well, they made it. They know how to do it. And they're not there to make more money. They're there, to, hopefully, to straighten it out so we all can make a little more money. And time will tell. We'll hold them accountable.
Another person who grew up around here is Todd Smola, who's now the local state rep. As a Republican, Smola says he voted for Trump, but not with a lot of enthusiasm. But he says he's not surprised that so many of his constituents support Trump, because he describes this part of the state as a place where deep family roots, religion, and gun rights are sacred, and where many people feel a world away from Boston.
There's this feeling of East versus West, you know, the famous line of if you're west of 128, you know, you're a different world. I do think that people out in this neck of the woods feel they're not as heard, and they don't have as much of a voice.
But Smola says the last election gave them a voice, and they used it to express their frustration about an economy that leaves too many behind and about a political system in Washington that can't fix it. So voters in places like Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Ware went with the outsider.
Rural communities like Ware are the ones that elected Donald Trump. So when they start paying attention to the needs of rural communities on the broader level, they'll recognize that they can move the world. And I think last November, that's what they did.
But Smola says now comes the hard part and the big question. Will President Trump deliver the change that so many people in this part of the state voted for?
Oh, yeah.
Hail, keep smiling, son.
I put that question to the guys drinking coffee on the bench in Gilbertville. Bill Ward says it's too soon to know, but he says voters like him will hold Trump accountable.
Well, I would cordially invite you guys back a year from now to see what's going on with the bench. That would answer any question you could possibly have.
For New England Public Radio, I'm Anthony Brooks.
And you can hear part one of that story, a trip to Winchendon, on our website, NEPR.net. The Trump administration recently announced it was rescinding protections for transgender students established by President Obama. The decision comes at a tough time for commentator and high school student Jay, who's known since childhood that he was a boy. The hard part has been trying to convince others that's who he is.
It's been obvious since the first day of kindergarten when my mom dressed me in all pink and I hated it so much. As I saw it, I was the only boy dressed that way. That same day, our teacher divided the class into two lines, a girl's and a boy's. Being assigned with the girls didn't feel right. As far as I was concerned, I belonged in the other one. A few years later, I saw an episode of Tyra Banks with a trans person on it. He said, "I'm a man, but I also have girl parts." I sometimes look for that old clip because it brought me so much joy to finally see someone like me on television. When puberty hit, I began researching different techniques for transitioning from female to male. Last year, I began binding my chest, and I get the most masculine haircut possible. I try to talk from the throat or chest in order to lower my voice. Sometimes, my family gets frustrated with me for behaving like this, for behaving like myself. It can be hard to leave my house. In public, at school and work, there's so much backlash. People call me a tranny or ask me things like, "Do you know you're going to hell?" Onlookers rarely intervene when people hurl slurs at me. And since the election, it's gotten so much worse. And then, there's the issue of bathrooms. If I go into the women's room, I can tell people think I'm a guy, even though biologically, I'm a woman. But walking into the men's room, where I'd rather be, is much worse. I get snide comments about not belonging there. One guy actually asked me threateningly, "What's between your legs?" The scariest thing that ever happened occurred recently. I was alone in a cafe in a small town in western Massachusetts. Four men came in and sat down at a table nearby. They were all much older. I sensed they were staring at me. One guy started talking loudly about how America had gone to hell. Another said he hated trannies. When someone boasted he would kill a tranny if he saw one go into the wrong bathroom, I quickly stole a glance at them. Three had hunting knives in their belts. The fourth guy's was out on the table. I left as fast as I could, counting the seconds between us. But I'm determined. I'm not going to let anyone who harasses me hold me back. I'm more and more taking the risk to be myself. I'm more and more believing there's nothing wrong with me.
That's our commentator, Jay. He attends high school in Springfield. Over the next few months, workers at the Springfield Armory will be digging a lot of dirt. They're restructuring parts of the armory's grounds to recreate the landscape of the National Historic Site to what it looked like in the 1950s. They'll even plant specific trees to match that era, which was the last time the armory was really in business, building and developing weapons for the U.S. military. New England Public Radio's Henry Epp met Armory Superintendent James Woolsey at the grounds, where he showed Henry how crews have been turning a field into a sloping hill.
So right here, and it's a little bit hard to see now with the piles of dirt, but this was this flat expanse right here, which was is completely unnatural. So right here, it was gently sloping like it is to the left. So it sloped down, and you could see these beautiful views downtown and then out to the river. Where this had this flat landscape right here. So what happened is in the late 1960s, the city of Springfield needed ball fields for the local high schools. So they basically took this fill dirt and made ball fields up there. And it's done a couple things. One is it's messed up the way the site is supposed to look historically. But also this fill has slumped and created bogs and unnatural drainage. So we get springs showing up where they shouldn't. And then when it rains, we get drastic floods that, you know, mess up State Street and do all kinds of damage. So we're not only going to recontour the landscape and reduce the risk of catastrophic floods, but make the site look beautiful like it's supposed to.
And for people that haven't been here, we're sort of up on a hill, right, sort of looking over downtown Springfield.
Absolutely. So the Springfield Armory is located up on this bluff for a reason. And the reason that it was located in Springfield was because it was well-positioned on transportation routes, so you could equip the army, essentially, but also was far enough away from the ocean so that a foreign power like England or France, who were our, at that time the people that we were most likely to go to war with, couldn't come here and steal all of our guns. And so it's up on a hill so that if, you know, sort of the British come, you can see the British coming.
And so this project that you're doing, the landscaping will be restored to what was here around the 1950s, right?
Yeah, yes.
But, I mean, as you said, the history of this armory goes back centuries beyond that. Why the 1950s? Why that era?
So what we do in the National Park Service is we pick a period of significance. So we look for when is the time that we want to kind of rehabilitate the site towards. And the reason we picked the 1950s is because the armory closed in 1968. So that's towards the end. However, the last 10 years of the armory's existence, there wasn't much management of the site because they knew they were going to close it. So the 1950s is kind of the end of active federal management. We don't want to pick earlier times because a lot of the buildings were built, you know, during World War II, let's say. So if we picked an earlier time, then you would, you know, well, would you need to tear down historic buildings? And no. So we kind of pick the end of the period of active management by the U.S. Army.
obviously there's centuries of significant American history here. Are there archaeologists on hand that could maybe come in if there's anything historically significant that is dug up?
Absolutely. I mean, we have prepared for this project for actually 5 years. We have archaeologists on site, and they are watching them, you know, as they dig. And in fact, we did find the foundations of a building. We can't date the foundations. However, there was pottery that was found, and tentatively it looks like it's about the 1760s that the pottery comes from. So if that correlates with the foundations predate the establishment of the Springfield Armory.
Looking into the Springfield Armory before we met, I noticed that Henry Wadsworth Longfellow wrote a poem about the arsenal here, and it's a pretty anti-war poem. I'm just curious how you think about the legacy of the armory in terms of both this sort of point of national pride, but also a manufacturer of weapons, instruments that were used to kill people.
The Springfield Armory, I think, tells a fascinating story, and it's a very complex story. And you're right. It, you know, part of the story is national defense, and there's a sense of pride in that. When you think about the M1 rifle, 5 million M1 rifles were made for our soldiers in World War II. When the soldiers, you know, stormed the beaches in France and liberated Europe, they were carrying a Springfield rifle with them. So that's, you know, a sense of pride. However, these rifles were used for lots of things. When Custer fought the Native Americans at Little Bighorn, he was carrying Springfield rifles, and he was using those rifles to kill Native Americans. And so it's a very complex story that we tell here. And I think that we should tell that story and all its complexity.
James Woolsey is superintendent of the Springfield Armory National Historic Site. Reading groups or book clubs are a long-standing tradition at many local libraries, but there's a new variety. Welcome cookbook clubs. It's part book club and part potluck gathering. Members pick one cookbook a month, claim recipes, and make the dishes. That's all NEPR's Carrie Healy needed to know before deciding to visit a meeting of the Library Cookbook Club in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. She filed this report.
I prepared tiny Spanish meatballs in almond sauce. The cookbook is a tapas cookbook. Meatballs are, you know, kind of comfort food.
In addition to making meatballs, Mary Lou Heisen co-organizes the cookbook club.
These people just kind of emerged and were interested for all different reasons. And I think it's a balance of socialization, and especially in the middle of winter like it is now, and everybody enjoys sharing food and talking about food.
Not everybody here actually is friends. It's not like a group that would meet
normally.
That's
right. This isn't like a little club that already existed in some other way. No.
Prepared dishes trickle in one by one. I peek into a deep-covered bowl being unpacked by Mary Jane Fromm.
This is actually a salad, an orange, fennel, and onion salad. But it is kind of nice, and the only problem is, of course, that you have to take all the pith out of the oranges.
Pith is the white part between the orange skin and the fruit.
That takes more time than one anticipates. It was fun, and I think it looks pretty.
Finishing touches like garnishing the deviled eggs with fresh dill, adding serving spoons and toothpicks are completed, and it's finally time to dig in. These cooks wanted more clarity from this month's book. They were looking for measurement equivalents for ingredients like onions and salt.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. That's what I wanted with the olives, too. Mm-hmm.
That's Barbara Allen. She made deviled eggs.
That's one of those things that I think everybody makes their own style. And you do it almost automatically. And so it's such an odd thing to use a recipe. But it was fun. It was.
Oh, look at how cutely you put the dill right into the eggs.
Oh, well, that's what the picture shows.
Apart from it being somewhat foreign to follow a recipe to make deviled eggs, Alan says she's challenged by recipes in general, but...
Because of the rules of the group, I have to use the recipes. And it's a learning experience for me.
And you ended up with a lot of extra dill. What are you planning on doing with that?
Trying to talk all the other ladies into taking some home.
Another member of the group, Debbie Wiswezer, says she doesn't venture too far from her comfort zone when cooking at home.
This gives me an opportunity to try things and really try them instead of just saying, I'm not in the mood to do this today. I have to be in the mood if I chose the recipe.
And Wiss Wesser was diligent about it. She bought a new nonstick pan to prepare crab tartlets.
This just kind of makes me sit and look at what things go together and how, you know, how they taste and how they are presented.
Anything especially challenging about making time available to, you know, make the dish and then bring the dish?
For me, no. I'm retired. I did have other plans for this morning, but it was exercise, and I'm always happy to find an excuse not to have to do it.
Full and fulfilled. Nobody at this Stockbridge Book Club meeting left wanting anything except the next meeting to come soon so they can taste recipes from a different cookbook.
And if I didn't say it, everybody take it home.
For New England Public Radio, I'm Carrie Healy.
That's all I have for you today. Thanks for listening to NEPR News Now, stories you really shouldn't miss. This show is produced by listener-funded New England Public Radio. Please give us a rating on iTunes, and while you're there, take a look at the other podcasts from NEPR. You can also see them at nepr.net/podcasts. You can support these podcasts and all the news and music NEPR delivers to your car, your home, and your phone. Just click the blue Contribute button near the top of the page. Again, thanks for listening. Until next time.